Okay, so this is number 43, and God willing, this is the last review session before we get on to some new material.
Well,
what's that?
God willing.
Yes, Deo Volente. There'll be, although there may be some overlap since we're going to do a few biographies first, so... Okay, so we left off last time in 1640 after the Second Bishops' War. Again, it was a disgraceful loss for Charles. They agreed to cease fire, but they left open the issue of the actual treaty, and that was to be resolved in London. Charles went back to London. He was forced to call a parliament. Yeah. This turned out to be a very bad idea for Charles, but he called it anyways. So-called Long Parliament. When in his opening speech to Parliament, he called the Scots rebels who should be chased out of England. You know, if they could chase him out of England, then they maybe wouldn't have to pay him £850 a day. But he soon found out he was out of touch with the parliamentary sentiment and had to backpedal. The Scottish commissioners arrived, and these would be the peace commissioners to settle the treaty, and they were accompanied by four ministers: Robert Blair, Robert Bailey, John Smith, and George Gillespie. And there they preached to large and enthusiastic crowds. It took almost a year till the 10th of August 1641 to settle the treaty. The English Parliament was one of the parties, as the Scots had demanded, and there were a variety of terms, but they include the fact that Charles agreed to publish the acts of the June 1640 Scottish Parliament under his name. Right, he initially insisted that the Parliament had been illegal because it met without his permission. So this had the effect of approving all of the acts of the Glasgow and Edinburgh General Assemblies, establishing a Parliament without bishops, eliminating Charles's control over the Lords of the Articles, and scheduling Parliament to meet at least every 3 years. Other terms: royal castles in Scotland were only to be used for defending the realm. Covenanters in England and Ireland couldn't be persecuted for having signed the national covenant. The king's advisors, if judged incapable by Parliament, would be fired and have no more access to him. Captured Scottish ships and goods would be returned, and for their troubles, the Scots were given either 220,000 or £300,000. And that was some real money. Let's see, the Scottish commissioners wanted uniformity of religion. Okay, in other words, a banning of episcopacy and establishing of Presbyterianism. The king and the parliament wouldn't agree to this. According to Stevenson, few English Puritans wanted Scots Presbyterianism established in England, although they did not openly admit this for fear of losing the support of their Scots allies in other matters. So the English, they only agreed to pursuing conformity of church government at some indefinite time in the future, which they worked on within a few years, but never, ever was really brought to a uniform situation. Okay, let's see. The English Parliament, while the treaty was underway, the English Parliament arrested Archbishop Laud and the Earl of Strafford. These were Charles's two advisors that encouraged him to go to war, the Second Bishop's War. The Earl of Strafford had been his, Charles's head man in Ireland for a while. Strafford was tried on 28 charges and was executed for them on the 12th of May, 1641. Charles had promised Strafford that he would never let any harm come to him. Charles later, I think on his deathbed, thought this was maybe one of the reasons why he got this punishment for going back on this. But, you know, he had plenty of things to choose from, so it's kind of hard to say. So. Okay, and Laud ended up being executed in 1645, so during the Civil War. Okay, but by this time, Charles is now having very significant problems, not just with the Scots, but also with his subjects in England. In the spring of 1641, it says February 1941 in my notes, but I think that's wrong. Parliament had considered the written branch petition. If you've ever heard this term, the written branch petition was supposed to abolish episcopacy with all its dependencies, roots, and branches. Didn't pass, you know, that it was under active consideration, so there was some concern on Charles's part. In the summer of 1641, England was a hotbed of unrest, and much of it revolved around the church. It was reminiscent of the rioting and iconoclasm that accompanied the Scottish Reformation, a lot of upheaval. And if you're interested, I would refer you to this book, Roundheads, or Cavaliers and Roundheads, on the English Civil War by Christopher Hibbert. Okay, let's see. Charles went back to Scotland at the when the treaty was concluded and presided over Parliament. He was somewhat compliant, hoping to break the Covenanters' alliance with the English Parliament, but he was unsuccessful. One issue that had been left open in the treaty negotiation was the appointment of officers of state, and the Covenanters wanted the authority to approve or veto his appointments. And this was left somewhat vague in the treaty, and so as a result, there was a very long dispute over who would be the chancellor. And Charles finally despaired of winning over the Covenanters, and for surprise, they didn't trust him. He returned to London mid-November of 1641, having given a lot of concessions to the Covenanters, and yet still having no not really gotten anywhere with them. I mean, they still didn't trust him, you know, and that's, I guess, the kind of outcome when you're known to be a liar. People still don't trust you no matter what. Towards the end of that time, in October 1641, the Irish rebelled. Okay, and this was one of the great Irish rebellions. And you might recall James had this plan to help subdue Ireland by planting Scottish Protestants in Ulster. There was a time when he was able to, he made some claim and took over some, can't remember the exact details, but took over some large estates in Ireland, in the province of Ulster. And he moved Scottish Presbyterians there to help subdue the, you know, the Irish. that, you know, the results of that brilliant plan of James are still with us today. You can still pick up any British newspaper on any given day and read about it. It's still there. Okay. During this rebellion, what the Irish Catholics murdered thousands of Protestants, okay, and thousands more were forced from their land. At the time, the number was claimed to be over 150,000. Some more recent scholarship claims it was closer to 4,000. Hard to say for sure, but whatever the actual number was, and whatever it was, there were many more that were plundered and pillaged and had to flee. It was a great tragedy, and that cruelty was remembered and was repaid for many years to come. So, let's see. Covenanters wanted to send an army to Ireland to help put down the rebellion. The king thought that was a good idea, because then he would get rid of some Scots from the mainland, as it were. And the English Parliament also had reasons for wanting them to go, but it took 6 months. And during that time, the uprising was known as the Queen's Rebellion. Right? She was a Catholic, and her enemies claimed that she was secretly supporting the uprising. Okay, in England, though, this conflict between the king and the parliament continued and it got stronger. In November, the parliament sent the king their grand remonstrance, which listed a mere 200 clauses detailing their complaints. And many of them were about the English church, which Charles still maintained wasn't in need of reform. the House of Lords was a little more evenly divided, so Charles attempted to maintain his stand and refused considering reforming the church. So he's trying to make a bold stand. He ordered crackdowns on protesters that were going on in the streets. He ordered the arrest of five of the most activist members of the House of Commons. Technically, he needed the order confirmed by the House of Commons, but of course that wasn't going to happen. So the Queen advised him, she's reported to have used the following language, "Go, you poltroon, go and pull those rogues out by the ears or never see my face again." Well, pretty much that ended up with it. She didn't pull her, he wasn't able to pull the rogues down by their ears, and almost never saw her face again. But he went down to Parliament in January 1642 with 400 armed men, and they, you know, the five guys that he wanted to get had fled. But nevertheless, sort of again revealed him to be the tyrant that he was. Okay, a few days later, he left Whitehall for Hampton Court, fearing for the life of his wife, at least, and perhaps his own. They moved on then to Windsor, and then from there, she, the Queen and Princess Mary traveled to the continent, and the Queen was supposed to look for military aid, but again, she never saw Charles again. That was the last she saw him. From there, Charles began moving north, going through Royston, Cambridge, Huntington, Lincoln, Stamford, and York. It's up the A1, isn't it, son?
Yeah.
So, up the east side of the country. While he was gone, Parliament was just going on, basically ruling the country. He tried to capture the port of Hull in April, and with the idea being that he would capture that and then the Queen would have a place to send supplies. but he was basically couldn't take the castle, so he had to turn around and go back to York. June, Parliament issued their 19 propositions. It required parliamentary control not only of the army but of the church, the royal children, the law, and all officers of state. And this is quoting from Hibbert. "They were in effect tantamount to a demand that the king must surrender all executive power. Outraged, he immediately rejected them, condemning their authors as raisers of sedition and enemies to my sovereign power, as would-be destroyers of rights and properties, of all distinctions of families and merit, persuading many waverers that Parliament had indeed presented him with an ultimatum that could be accepted only with dishonor." Okay, the whole country went on a war footing, and you start to see minor skirmishes. In July, he began a siege of Hull that failed. He marched south towards London, raised his standard at Nottingham on the 22nd of August, 1642, proclaimed that the Commons and their troops were traitors. At that time, he only had about 1,000 men, and the situation looked somewhat desperate, but it was soon to change in his favor. Parliament passed a measure that said that everyone who wasn't supporting the Parliament were delinquents and that their property could be seized, and that apparently pushed some people maybe who weren't really in favor of Charles but didn't want to, you know, take sides with the Parliament to go over to the Royalist side. First serious battle was fought on the 23rd of September at Powick Bridge near Worcester. This is of the English Civil War. Through 1642 and 1643, the war didn't go very well for the parliamentary faction. The king was able to increase the size of his army quite a bit. It was moderately successful. The English Parliament was therefore very eager to get the help of Scott's army. And they were currently fielding this army in Ireland. And the English began to negotiate with the Scots over obtaining some military aid. Let's see. The Scots made several offers to help mediate the dispute between the king and Parliament, but as you can imagine, the king wasn't particularly eager to have his Scottish brethren negotiate. Let's see. The king sent a letter to the Scottish Privy Council, and there was this debate over whether or not to publish it, and they finally decided to, and that got the Covenanters somewhat angry, and they afterwards they started really governing through committees appointed by the Scottish Parliament. The Covenanters appointed four commissioners, or I should say the Conservators, which were this committee of Parliament, appointed four commissioners to go to England to mediate in the Civil War. And the church appointed Alexander Henderson, this Edinburgh minister, as a fifth commissioner. They traveled to Oxford, where the king was at, it was headquartered, but they didn't get a very warm welcome. But he did manage to stall them, which was, of course, one of his strategies. So, until the 19th of April, 1643. So that was a 9-month stalling. The king tried to get the commissioners to see sort of his side of it or the side that he wanted them to see. In other words, that he hated popery. He said that, you know, Parliament had said that his forces were mostly papists, but he claimed the parliamentarians who opposed him were mostly Brownist, Anabaptist, and Independents. There's, you know, some truth to that. There, you know, it's not the whole truth, but that there's some truth to that. Who had no intention of introducing Presbyterian church government in England. Yeah, that's in the event, that's pretty much what happened. While their malicious suggestions that the king was victorious in England, he would no longer observe the new laws concerning church and state that he had approved in Scotland in 1641 were completely false, according to the king. Hard to say, but knowing Charles's nature, that would have been quite likely too. Then when they came back in May of 1643, a joint meeting of the Privy Council and the Parliamentary Conservators called a convention of estates, and they had to get some representatives from England there to sort of settle this business, and there was a long delay. But meanwhile, in England, the situation continued to look bleak for the parliamentary forces. Bristol fell in July of 1643, and the English Parliament called then the Westminster Assembly, and the principal purpose of the assembly was to settle the issue of religion in England. Right? And it was an assembly of learned, godly, and judicious divines. And a secondary reason would have been to provide a basis of unity with the church in Scotland and Protestant churches on the continent. And the king ordered that this, you know, from Oxford, ordered that the assembly not meet, but it met anyways. But his fact that he proclaimed that might have kept some of the Episcopalian-leaning divines at home rather than at the assembly. So, shortly thereafter, they'd be joined by the Scottish, some Scottish representatives. But in the meantime, English commissioners came north to meet in Edinburgh with the Scottish Convention of Estates, and the English knew that basically the Scots would want to have a unified basis of church government in both countries, and the English wanted the Scots military aid. So, as one contemporary, Robert Bailey, said, the English were for a civil league, we for a religious covenant. Hence the Solemn League and Covenant. The English commissioners requested that the Scots send representatives. Right, and these included Alexander Henderson, Robert Bailey, Robert Douglas, George Gillespie, and Samuel Rutherford. And they traveled there down to Westminster shortly thereafter. So, the English commissioners were there. They needed the Scots military aid. And Alexander Henderson drafted the Solemn League and Covenant. Okay, and that's another famous church document. I actually have a handout of an original version printed on my laser printer this morning. And I think there's 9 copies, so if you... So... Okay, we'll spend a little time on the details, but first it was both a civil league and a religious covenant. Despite the fact that the English had delayed so long in sending commissioners, there was a real sense of expediency. Let's see. Within 10 days, actually, the Solemn League and Covenant was approved by the English commissioners and the Scottish Church General Assembly. And it was then shortly sent to the English Parliament, where it was also approved. The English Parliament made changes that, in the wording of the first article of the Covenant, according to Stevenson, designed to avoid committing Parliament too explicitly to following the Scottish model and reforming the Church of England, while not going so far as to risk rejection of the alterations by the Scots. There's a key term here that, if you read it, might strike you as being somewhat vague, and that's that the churches in England and Ireland would be reformed, quote, according to the Word of God and the example of the best reformed churches. Right? Obviously, by the Scots, that was taken to mean Presbyterianism. And what else could it mean, the best reformed churches? But the English viewed that as some wiggle room, that they could mean something else later. Okay, that same day, then the Convention of the States started making arrangements to send troops to England. Treaty for sending the troops was approved on the 26th of August, and the terms were that the Solemn League and Covenant should be sworn both in England and Scotland, and the Scots should send an army in England to support the Solemn League and Covenant, and to support the English Parliament, of course. The Scottish were to pay for the army while they were in the field, but the English agreed to reimburse the Scots when the war was won. And they agreed not to make separate peace agreements, and agreed to mutual aid and assistance. So if Scotland was attacked, England agreed to go to her aid. The fact that this was all approved within 3 weeks from the time the English commissioners arrived shows somewhat how urgently it was important it was. The war up until this point had not gone well at all for the English Parliament. The tide didn't turn soon. All hope would be lost, or so it appeared at the time. The English Parliament quickly reviewed the documents, revised them, and by the 11th of October, the Commission of the Church of Scotland agreed to the revisions. So, given the fact that they weren't using the internet and so on, it was quite rapid turnaround. Okay, so I've handed you a copy of the Solemn League and Covenant, which I'll assign you to read this afternoon. I think the main, if you read the beginning, it sounds much like the other Scottish covenants, right? You know, we, noblemen, barons, knights, gentlemen, et cetera, are planning to do this, all right? And that goes on and on, so I won't read it, but you've got it there. Then there's six articles. The first two cover the religious aim, and the last four cover the civil aim. I already mentioned the first one, that the churches in England and Ireland were to be reformed according to the example of the best reformed churches. That the churches in all three kingdoms were to be brought in to the nearest conjunction and uniformity in religion, confession of faith, form of church government, directory for worship and catechizing. Okay, that we and our posterity after us may as brethren live in faith and love, and the Lord may delight to dwell in the midst of us. Right, so in the Westminster Assembly, that's where all this was worked out. The confession of faith, the form of church government, directory of worship, the catechisms, those were all products of the Westminster Assembly. Interestingly enough, they weren't all approved in England. I don't know if any were ever approved in Ireland in a general sense. But there were, I think they were all approved in Scotland. I mean, the Directory of Worship certainly is. In the second part, then, they endeavor the extirpation of popery and prelacy. Right? So, in other words, episcopacy. And then in the next four articles, they go on to the civil aspects of this that will preserve the rights and privileges of the parliaments, Also to preserve and defend the King's Majesty's person and authority, which may seem a little strange given the fact that the English Parliament was actually at war with the King. The Scots certainly, perhaps more so than the English, but both nations still maintained at least a respect for the office of King, you know, if not for the King himself. One that we find hard to understand today, but nevertheless, there you have it. You'll see this comes out again and again.
You only have to think of the last 30 minutes.
Yeah. Yes, no, that's right. The last president was some parallel, but we might have respected the office, but not the man. So, also, a lot of times you'll see that the there's a difference drawn. It's assumed that the king's getting bad advice, so it's his advisors that are at fault. Maybe, you know, partly true, but. Okay, so they agree then to preserve each other's rights, to to search out people who are propagandizing for the king's side or for episcopacy side, and bring them to public trial and receive condign punishment. They endeavor that they may remain conjoined in a firm peace and union to all posterity. Okay, and that so that the two countries would be joined together. Although this was done in a more formal sense, a more formal union in the early 1700s. But and finally, then in the sixth one, they promised to give military aid. They'll assist and defend all those that enter into the League and Covenant, and shall not suffer ourselves directly or indirectly by whatsoever combination, persuasion, or terror to be divided or withdrawn from this blessed union conjunction. And they'll all the days of our life zealously and constantly continue therein against all opposition and promote the same according to our power. Okay. So, that is the Solemn League and Covenant, one of the great Scottish documents. One that, if we have more time, we could discuss what it means today. But since I really want this to be the last review session, we're going to go on. The Solemn League and Covenant was sworn widely in Scotland, very broadly. In England, it was signed by the Parliament and apparently signed reasonably widely among the population. Ireland actually was added by the English Parliament, and I'm not really sure what their motivation was in doing it. As far as I can tell, it wasn't signed widely in Ireland. I mean, other than it was signed by the military in Ireland and presumably by the Ulster Protestants, but I guess I don't expect that it was signed by very many Catholics. So. Dave, did your ancestor sign it? Okay. Yeah. Here, put your mark here. Okay.
I suspect you're probably right. It's true that I don't think at that time England had firm control over the various small kingdoms in Ireland.
Okay, the assembly, Westminster Assembly, then was tasked to basically do all these things that were part of the Solemn League and Covenant. In other words, they were got the official order here, but they they were supposed to come up with a church discipline and government that may be most agreeable to God's holy word. And the government was to be settled in this church instead in place of the present church, governed by archbishops, bishops, their chancellors, commissaries, deans, da-da-da-da-da. They were supposed to come up with a directory of worship and so on. So that official order was made to the the Westminster Assembly to do that. And about this time, well, let's see, that was October 1643. On the 19th of January 1644, the Covenanter army crossed into England. It was led by the Alexander Leslie, the Earl of Leven. They had 18,000 infantry, 3,000 cavalry, and 18 medium heavy guns and 42 three-pounders. Let's see. The Scottish army wasn't initially overwhelming. They were probably a little overconfident. The way they'd won these last two bishops' wars with scarcely shot being fired. But within about 6 months, the tide started to change. And in my opinion, the Covenanters did shift the whole balance of power. For what my opinion is worth, which is not very much in this case. But shortly thereafter, on the 20th of March 1644, they successfully captured the South Shields Fort near Newcastle. They didn't succeed in taking the city of Newcastle at that time, but they did draw a number of troops away from York. And a lot of course, the way the battle shifted was by the king having to redeploy forces to meet the Scots and was therefore weaker in other spots. In July of 1644, there was a very large battle fought at Marston Moor, which is just west of York. We'll skip over the details, although... Okay. The Parliamentary and Covenanter forces were about 28,000 strong. This included the Covenanter army. I'm not sure if it was all 21,000, but it included at least a significant part. Prince Rupert, who was a king's nephew, I think. Is that Simon? Is that right? Scotland, our English history expert. He had a force of 14,000 men. They just managed to lift the siege of Newcastle. The Allied army tried to cut him off on his return. He decided to attack their rear guard, but he waited for additional reinforcements who were supposed to come from Newcastle. One of the reasons the troops coming from Newcastle were slow is because they were stopping to pick up shoes that were left behind by the Allied army. So... This gave the Allied army time to regroup their forces, and the Royalist army had the upper hand for a while until the Scottish cavalry routed Prince Rupert's cavalry. He'd been killing his horse from underneath him. Cromwell wasn't even on the battlefield at that time, and the cavalry was then used to crush the Royalist infantry. All 6,000 Royalist troops were killed or captured. This ended the Royalist domination of the northern part of the country. And then can't resist reading this quote from James King Hewison. With unpardonable mendacity, Cromwell accepted all the credit of the victory accorded to him by the Independent Party and concealed the splendid feats of the Scots, who undoubtedly rescued both Cromwell and the English army from destruction. Meanwhile, with the Scots coming south, there has been another change in Scotland, and the Earl of Montrose had been originally a Covenanter. One claimed actually to be Covenanter to his death, but just claimed that the Covenanters had gone too far in deciding to challenge the king in the Civil War. He left the Covenanter side, started out on his own, started working actually for the king. He was able to raise armies in Scotland, and he was commissioned by the king to be his lieutenant general of the north in February 1644. And he was joined by Irish forces, so Irish Catholics who came over. In July, he had between 2,000 and 3,000 Irish Catholic troops came, landed in the west of Scotland, and they were joined by 800 Highlanders. and they were met with Montrose and formed a single force. They went on a rampage in Scotland, and for nearly a year, or a little over a year, they had a series of successful battles. September 1644, they killed 2,000 Covenanter soldiers near Perth. In February 1645, there was a battle at Inverlochy, and 1,500 Covenanter soldiers were killed, captured Dundee in April. In May, there was a battle fought east of Inverness where 2,000 Covenanter troops were killed. In July of 1645 at Alford, northwest of Aberdeen, 1,600 Covenanter soldiers were killed. There were some, Montrose had some losses too, but by and large these were routs. In August of 1645 at the Battle of Kilsyth, which is south of Stirling, some 4,000 Covenanter soldiers were killed. Okay, and so if you think about the scale of things, that's what, 4,000, 6,000, 8,000. You know, this is 10 or 11,000, right? And the Scottish army that had gone south in England was 21,000. So this is a significant number of men in those days. Finally, though, at Philiphaugh, which is near the border with England, Montrose was decisively defeated on September 13th of 1645. And that basically ended the major sort of resistance in Scotland. Okay, Parliament then passed the Act of Classes in January 1646, which prevented anyone who had followed Montrose from holding a public office. There's another Act of Classes which is yet to come that becomes a more important part of the debate over the relationship between the church and state, but this is just a forerunner. General Assembly met in May of 1647, disciplined ministers who had royalist leanings, specifically ones who had signed a royalist bond. Montrose escaped Philiphaugh and rode north into the Highlands. In November 1646, he sailed on a Norwegian vessel to the continent, where he spent 4 years. Tried to organize some further action for the king, but to no avail. And by the spring of 1646, the tide had pretty much turned. Things were looking pretty poor for Charles. Lost a major battle at Naseby in June of 1645. His correspondence with the queen had been captured, which showed he'd been trying to bring foreign papist troops over, which is a real public relations blow. In September 1645, I think I mentioned this already, Bristol had been lost by the royalists. Cromwell continued sending back reports which played up the contributions of the independents, right? And these are the people who have separated from any established church and don't wish to be part of the Episcopal Church, but don't wish to be part of the Presbyterian Church either. That fall and winter, a number of the royalist strongholds, including the city of Chester, key if the king wanted to use any Irish reinforcements, surrendered in January 1646. All the king's efforts at getting help from Spain, France, and the Pope failed. As Christopher Hibbert said, the king's schemes never worked out as he planned they should. Since it was a sad, inescapable fact that his promises were not believed anymore, either in the country or outside it. He was not trusted to stand by his word, even if he had the power and means to do what he promised to do. He was judged to be even more deceitful than most monarchs were. And on the 21st of March, 1646, the last royalist army in the field was defeated near Stow-on-the-Wold. And the king, with little hope left, decided to go over to the Covenanter army. He arrived there at their headquarters in May. And for about 8 months, they tried to persuade him to agree to the solemn league and covenant. And he wrote a letter to his wife complaining that he'd never known what it was to be barbarously baited before. But he refused to compromise, and in the end, the Scots handed him over to the English Parliament. They were then paid the money that they were owed, or a substantial part of it, which then opened them up to charges later that they had sold their king. The traitor Scott sold his king for a groat. And I'm not sure what a groat is exactly.
It's a type of coin.
Type of coin, okay. Okay. In November, he escaped and fled to Carisbrooke Castle on the Isle of Wight in the English Channel. And there was a party of Scots nobility that went to see the king, and they worked out a deal which was called the engagement. And the agreement was really between the Scottish noblemen and the king, but it had implications for their relationship with Parliament. The terms were the king would have both the English and Scottish parliaments affirm the solemn league and covenant, provided that no one was forced to take it. So that would have force of law. The king would establish Presbyterian church government in England for 3 years. The king would continue the Westminster Assembly for 3 years. He would suppress the opinions and practices of anti-Trinitarians, Anabaptists, Antinomians, Arminians, Familists, Brownists, Separatists, Independents, Libertines, and Seekers. Okay, and the Scots would have been quite happy with that, and so would the king. It's just all those people in Britain that wouldn't have been, England that wouldn't have been so happy. And then the Scots army would restore the king to power. So this was an attempt at a compromise, basically. And although it was viewed pretty negatively by the Covenanters. The Convention of States met in Edinburgh in March, and they actually approved the engagement, but it was strongly resisted by the radical party, what you might call the radical party of the church, Gillespie Rutherford et al., and was condemned by the General Assembly. It was condemned because, while condemned independency, never spoke of episcopacy at all. It caused a breach between England and Scotland. In other words, they had agreed, right, in the Solemn League and Covenant not to make separate peace agreements, and that's what they were doing. It trespassed on the liberties of the church, and is still somewhat Erastian in nature, in the whole way that it, you know, the king's going to set up this Presbyterian church government, he's going to continue the Westminster Assembly, and so on. While the General Assembly was meeting, the Duke of Hamilton, a Scottish Duke, crossed the border into England with an army of 10,500 infantry and cavalry. He was joined by 36 English soldiers who were apparently leftover royalists. And Cromwell, meanwhile, came north and led an army of 8,000. Who soundly defeated the engagers' army at Preston Moor on the River Ribble. And so, in a sense, I mean, it's fair to say the Scots, or at least part of them, had gone back on their word, and now Cromwell is enforcing that. Cromwell took 10,000 prisoners and sent them off to the plantations as slaves, or to Venice as soldiers. And when the news of defeat came, Argyll, who had opposed the engagement, they formed a new government. A group of Covenanters from the western lowlands marched to Edinburgh and seized the castle in the so-called Whigamore's Raid. First time, I think, in class we hear the Covenanters referred to as Whigs, but that's how they're often referred to. Cromwell proceeded on to Edinburgh, arrived on the 4th of October, where he met with the new government, and the meeting was fairly amicable. And in January 1649, the House of Commons established a high court in England to try Charles. I guess they'd recaptured him at this point. I didn't really mention that, but during the month, he was impeached as being a tyrant, traitor, murderer, and a public implacable enemy of the Commonwealth of England. And by the end of the month, 30th of January, he'd been pronounced guilty, sentenced, and beheaded. And still, some of the Scots, within a week, the Chancellor, surrounded by members of Parliament, marched to the Cross of Edinburgh and issued a proclamation that Charles II was now the second was now the King of Great Britain, France, and Ireland. It was later formulated in a statute, and it was contingent on Charles II accepting the two covenants, Westminster Standards, Presbyterial Church Government, and removing Montrose from his presence. The same month, the Scots Parliament passed acts condemning the engagement, and they passed an act of classes, another one, which this time prohibited those who had supported the engagement from serving in public office. And the supporters of the engagement were divided in four classes, and their length of banishment from public life could be anywhere from life to a year. But those who didn't receive the life sentence had to publicly repent before they could be returned to office. And the effects of this act of classes, we'll see later, was, among other things, there was further division, and we can probably think about to what extent this was the right approach later, but just at this point, it just say it came up. And that concludes our 7-week review, but it was a 36 lectures, so there's a 5-to-1 compression ratio, so I thought it wasn't that bad. So, any questions?
If this solemn making covenant was ratified by parliaments of both nations, and it says it was eventually signed by King Charles II, did it actually have legal effect in any way?
Well, it certainly did through the English Civil War. I mean, you can see already by the time that we Cromwell consolidates his power in the interregnum that the English start to neglect their obligations under this. In one sense, Cromwell neglected it in one way, in that he was an independent and he wanted basically complete freedom of worship for everybody, no matter how bizarre. May not be fair, quite fair, but he wanted freedom of worship and did not want to establish Presbyterianism. And then in the when the Restoration happened, Charles II came back. He tried to reinstate episcopacy, or did reinstate episcopacy, and declared that it had no, explicitly repudiated the solemn leaving covenant, had no legal standing. So, now, then the history of the Covenant of Church of One is, of course, one of, in Scotland, of saying, well, this is still, a covenant made before God, and you can't just say, sorry, we changed our minds. So,
specifically, the move in Scotland in the last few decades, at least, to separate to a certain extent from England. Whether this would still be considered.
Well, I'm sure that the people that voted to establish a Scottish Parliament and so on probably didn't give a 2-second thought to the Solemn League Covenant. There's still a small number of people who attach some significance to it. But I'd say today it's in terms of public opinion and so on, it's completely a dead issue. So, I mean, now we could argue whether or not that should be so, but I mean, just in terms of people, in terms of thinking about this, it's pretty much it's not thought of today. So. Other questions? Okay, well, I'm sure you're just all blown away by the. We'll stop there then.